the confusion on their faces, so he prompted Argmore to ask the obvious question. "The blessings upon the weapons grant us the power to destroy the villagers," the young warrior pointed out. "What gain in ignoring that?"
"We'll not enter a village," Teolik replied. "Uskar is thick with foodstuffs this season."
"Then with Umas," Agart remarked.
"Thick enough," Teolik answered. "We go to the lake to take one lakeman or woman or child. It does not matter. And that slave will be brought to Fearloxbuer to await Isabel's bloody face."
He had the three looking to each other in confusion, which made him smile all the wider.
"And with that slave, we will avenge Breith," he said.
And that brought confused stares that turned into horrified expressions, as they each remembered how Breith had died.
"The Fossa!"
Agmor breathed, and swallowed hard.
"We will lure the demon out with the slave, and then we will kill it," Teolig informed them.
They didn't seem very excited about the proposition.
"I know how to kill it,"
the Uskar Lauch asserted with confidence. "I could have killed it that day when it took Breith."
"But you did not,"
Agmor said. "Because I did not know the truth of the beast until we crashed together, and then it was too late to strike. But now, I know."
He considered reaching into his secret pouch to bring forth the amethyst-speckled sunstone, but decided against it. He had never shown that to any in the tribe. If the coven ever found out the properties of that item, the result would not be good for him.
"You are afraid," Teolig said against the wall of silence. "You doubt me."
"Never, war leader," all of them said immediately.
"Yes, you do," he countered. "And you are right to be fearful. But I am not, because I know. I will kill the demon Fossa. I need only a lure to bring it out, and you three to corner the beast that I can finish it."
"Could we not just use one of the Umas we have?"
Ralid asked.
"The idiot boy, Thump,"
Agard added, and the others nodded.
"He works the stair of the way, in service to the coven," Teolik told them. "Uskar Forfak Rebert watches him. He will not do. I will send you three down to find a slave. You three alone. More glory is yours."
"And we will kill the Fossa?"
Agmor asked.
"I will kill the Fossa," Teolik corrected. "But in that too, you will gain glory and standing, if you survive."
The young warriors exchanged looks again, full of trepidation, but mixed with intrigue.
"When must we choose?" Ralid asked.
"You already have," said Teolig. "The choice was made when I asked you out here, and the choice was agreed when you came to this gathering. Now you'll be silent, for it's our own secret. And any who are whispering will feel my wrath."
He reached behind a tree and produced a large sack, tossing it to the ground before the three. Its contents clanged and scraped, and the top fell open, revealing a cache of weapons. Not the crystal-tipped Uskar spears, but metal weapons the raiders had taken from the villagers over the years.
"Pick and practice," Teolik told them. "With these, you will catch my lure, and with these you will help me kill the demon Fossa."
He slowly brought his index finger up over his pursed lips, and left them with a not subtle reminder. And... 30. The Owl and the Snake. Owlin emerged from the crystal caverns to find a blustery and chilly wind, the first harbinger of an approaching autumn. When one gust hit her so hard that it moved her sideways a couple of steps, she had to wonder if she could safely fly this night. Would she glide down the mountain, only to be blown into a rocky crag? The young woman dismissed the thought, confident that the moonstone she had secured to her belly would allow her to get down safely. Indeed, Aulon was full of confidence this night, so much so that she had considered exiting the caverns by daring the darkness of the pit once more to float up through Crea Sadeath. She had even started that way, ready to face the ghosts, or whatever they were. She had changed her mind, though, for she had accomplished much, but had already spent too long out here. Again. Besides, she wanted to try out her new powers, and her new anklet. She had been quite busy, weaving a whetstone wire in and out of the skin of her left ankle, a double strand. On one were two small bars of the grey stone with which she could create lightning, along with a pretty blue stone she had not completely discerned. Even more confusing to her were the purplish chips of sapphire on that second strand. She knew the gem from the mundane jewellery the tribe had stolen from Lakeman, but she couldn't quite discern its magical properties, although it seemed to have something to do with enhancing or shaping the energy of other stones. Yes, the blue zircon and the sapphires would need much further investigation, Aulon decided. But not this night, for she had also crafted new earrings, and these she knew how to use, and more importantly, why to use them. The powerful garnet dangled on a whetstone chain from her right ear, but her left had a cuff of turquoise with a cat's eye gemstone set upon it. She closed her eyes and tapped that ear now, using the touch to focus her energy. She opened her eyes to a new world, it seemed, where the low starlight was no hindrance to her vision, other than to steal color. Fiorach's Buer was all greys and shadows before her, but every rock, every blade of grass was distinct. She could see as well as the nocturnal hunting cats, could navigate by starlight, as if it were high noon. She spent a long while adjusting to this new vision, basking in the serene beauty of it, filled with awe and appreciation. She had intended to go straight off to visit Badlan, but it would have to wait, for Aulon wanted to fly with her new vision, wanted to feel the wind, and defeat it. She moved to the edge of the nearest cliff and just let herself fall off, bringing forth the powers of the green and blue-white stones set to her belly. She was gliding then, riding the high winds as easily as a hawk, floating with magic instead of wings. Down she went, down and around the mountain, until she came in sight of the fires of the Uskar encampment. Burning low, she noted, reminding her that she had been in the cavern for a long while this night. It bothered her more than she had expected to realize that she wouldn't see Badlan. With a sigh, Aulon floated to a nearby pine, the tallest she could see, and settled easily upon a high branch, using just enough of the malachite's power to keep the branch from bending. There, from that perch, she studied the nighttime world around her. Movement on the ground to the side caught her attention, and she smiled widely when a beautiful fox trotted out gracefully from some brush. This would be her first capture, she thought, and she brought her hand back to her left ear, to the turquoise cuff, and she focused upon that and upon the whetstone to flee her spirit. And like an arrow, Aulon's sensibilities shot away, flying for the fox, flying into the fox. And she could see the world through the fox's eyes, and hear the world through the fox's ears. And she wanted to hear the fox's call, so she compelled it to cry out. Most of all, Aulon read the animal's thoughts, and felt as it felt. It knew she was there, or that something was inside of it at least. But another urge called. Aulon heard the scrabbling of a creature. She thought it a large creature, but no. It was just a mouse, some distance away, scrambling under some leaves. The fox stood very still, ears turning, honing in, and then the fox jumped up high and came straight down. Aulon tasted the blood of a mouse. The shock of the kill and suddenness of the attack had her fleeing back to her own form. Up high in the tree, The young woman giggled at her own squeamishness. But oh, what a grand gift this was! To understand the animals, to commune with them, to see and hear and smell the world through the animals of Firaxbuer. She heard a hoot. She went perfectly still, perfectly silent, scanning the trees with her enhanced cat's-eye vision. Finally, she spotted the source, a great horned owl, sitting on a branch not so far away. From her nighttime soaring about the mountain, Owlin thought she understood the freedom of flying, but her movements seemed crude and clumsy indeed after she entered the sensibilities of that owl. She could see many times better than her cat's eye, many times better than the fox even. The sounds of the mountain assailed her. Hoots and howls, rustling leaves, blowing grasses, the wind through the stones. Such a dizzying, beautiful cacophony. The sounds of the mountain night were more alive than any dull-sensed human could begin to imagine. It took little urging for her to get the bird to take wing, and then Owlin knew true freedom. Gliding silently, the owl cut through the wind and maneuvered through the trees with such perfect ease, passing dizzyingly close to tree trunks and thick branches. Through the owl's amazing ears, Owlin even heard herself gasp from way back on her pine perch. She forgot all about Budlan. She willed the bird closer to the Uska campfire as soon as it came within sight, curious to see the encampment through this creature's eyes. What secrets might she see? She was charmed indeed when she first flew past the camp, for it did not disappoint. She heard Mehren snoring, and it sounded like thunder, though she was certain that if she had been walking by the Crystal Maven's tent in her own body, with her own ears, she wouldn't have heard it at all. She heard giggling from another tent, but decided not to pursue it. She heard as the fire crackled, and then saw one of the warrior sentries peeing in the woods. She felt naughty and godlike, all at once. The owl swooped over and around the large encampment, then off into the night. But before it left the Uska behind, Owlin noted something else, something curious. She saw a form, a woman, slipping away from one of the tents, rushing from shadow to shadow into the night and back toward the Uma's pine grove. It wasn't a warrior going to rape a slave, she knew. So she urged the owl to turn back. It wasn't an Uskar at all. She got only one more glimpse of the woman, but it was enough for her to know it was Inava, Budlan's mother. But why? Thoughts of Inava's strange movements in the Uskar camp had flown from Owlin's mind by the time she had released the owl from her magical grasp and returned fully to her own body, still perched easily upon the branch. Although that branch was bending more now, as she had lost some concentration on the levitational magic. Still, she didn't fall. She leapt away and brought forth the magical powers of her own flight. How clumsy she felt then, compared to the freedom afforded in the owl's form, and Owlin winced to think how slow and clumsy she'd be without the magical powers she had discovered. It was too late to go to Budlan, she knew, so she sat down outside the camp, behind her tent, and quietly sneaked in. Her mind was so full of possibilities and thrills of that night that she feared she wouldn't sleep at all. She was wrong. She was soon snoring, thoroughly exhausted from her overuse of magic, but she dreamed the most amazing dreams, of flying and dancing with the animals. She also dreamed of Badlan. Perfect, wonderfully wicked dreams. She awoke with a start, surprised that it was light, and that, from the sounds around her, it had come some time ago. She wasn't sure why she had awakened so suddenly, until she heard a scream, a horrifying shriek that chilled her to the bone. She rolled out of bed and was moving before she even had time to think about what could be wrong, scrambling to and through the tent flap. Many were out and about, calling and rushing to and fro, but most were converging on the center of that camp, near the main bonfire pit. And Aulin's eyes widened when she noted the source of the screams. The witch, Kaya, staggered. She wore only her shift, which had been torn. Looking down at Kaya's bare legs, she noted a white-furred serpent hanging by one fang from her inner thigh, its length dragging on the ground behind her. The snake wriggled, coiling about, trying to pull free, for its fang was hooked and caught deep into the woman's flesh. A warrior ran over and stomped upon the serpent, and Kaya's forward motion tore it free of her leg at last, sending her stumbling and tumbling to the ground. The serpent turned on the man, coiling to strike, but it was Aulin, amazingly and completely on instinct, who struck first, stomping her foot and calling upon the blue stone in her anklet. A patch of ice appeared beneath the man and the snake, and when the snake struck, it slid and missed, and when the man tried to dodge, he slipped and fell backward, crashing into the scorched remains of the previous night's fire. Now other warriors converged, stabbing their spears to kill the serpent, while some women, including Conobra of the Coven, ran to the fallen Kaya, who was sobbing and shaking her head, spitting curses in denial. Aulin immediately shrank back, not wanting to reveal that her jewelry, most of which remained hidden, was more than ornamental. What had she done? She wasn't even certain. Several of her gemstones had called to her at once, a minded jumble of how to react. The blue stone on her anklet could create ice. Now she knew. But she didn't want anyone else to. She certainly didn't maintain the enchantment, and the warriors all moved about curiously, shrugging and shaking their heads. One called out for the witch responsible to come forth and be hailed as a hero. But when no one took credit, another claimed that the white-furred snake must have done it. "A foul beast with freezing breath," another agreed. Aulin stayed far back and out of the debate. She kept her gaze locked on Kaya, and it was not a pleasant sight. The woman went into violent convulsions and began spewing up white foamy spittle. Conobra prayed over her with a wedstone crystal, but seemed to be doing little good. Aulin thought she should go and help, for surely Kaya's life was more important than her secret. But Merin appeared and ran to Conobra's side, and Aulin shrank back farther, melting back into her tent to dress for the day. Only then did she remember the sight of Inova running from a tent, from Kaya's tent, she realized, when she had flown past in the body of the owl. Merin exited Kaya's tent, exhausted from her long hours of working the wedstone to alleviate the poor woman's terrible suffering. 3 of the 12 coven sisters were in there now, to be replaced by 3 others in shifts that went all day and all night. The sisters poured out their hearts and magic for poor Kaya, whose eyes were rolled back, who shivered constantly while drooling white spittle without pause. Merin rubbed her face and made her way to her own tent. They had to try. She noticed Tay Orley coming at her before she reached the tent flap, so she picked up her pace, not wanting to deal with the man, with anyone. But, unsurprisingly, Tay Orley just pushed into the tent behind her.
"I am tired, Uskar Lauch," she told him, holding her arm up to keep him at bay.
He just pushed past her.
"Aulin will replace Kaya as the 13th, he said, as she started to tell him to leave.
Meryn's protest stuck in her throat with surprise that this man would say such a thing. Tay Orlig was Uskar Lauch, yes, and among the most powerful men in the tribe. But the coven was not his concern.
"The 13th, she gasped. "Kaya still breathes."
"You cannot save her. It was a white-furred viper. There is no magic to defeat that poison."
"She still breathes."
"We've seen this before,"
Tay Orlik replied somberly, shaking his head.
"This is not your concern."
"It is. Aulin will be the 13th.
"That is not your choice," Meryn told him, and she started past him, grabbing him by the arm to escort him out of her tent. But the powerful man tugged back, spinning Meryn on her feet to face him.
"Olin," he said.
Meryn tried to pull free, but the man wouldn't let her go, and nothing short of a lightning bolt would break this one's iron grip, and now he was hurting her. She wriggled again, futilely.
"It is not wise for a man to hurt the Uskarigin," Meryn warned, regaining her composure, and pointedly straightening.
She was surprised when Te'olik let her go.
"Olin," he said.
But it was more a plea now.
"Kaya
is soon dead," he said sharply, jolting her with his intensity, and reminding her that she couldn't get away from him unless he allowed her to.
And the look on his face. There it was, Meryn realized. And of course, she had suspected as much from the first whispers of Te'olig's surprising choice in a wife. He wasn't in love with Aulin, but with the power the promising young witch could bring to him. Meryn had heard of Breyth's exploits in the battle, before the Fossa had taken him. Even in that fight with the Fossa, the man, or rather, Aulin working through him, had floated and thrown bolts of powerful lightning at the demon beast. Truly, Aulin had shown herself well in that battle, by all accounts of those in the field. And now, Te'olig had come to believe that she would serve his ambitions well. His ambitions, despite the threatening circumstances. A smile began to creep onto Meryn's face.
"You would be Uskar Tríath," she said. "That is your plan."
She knew she had hit on the truth, as Te'olig backed away a step.
"Elder Rebert is not well. This you know," Meryn reasoned.
Te'olig didn't respond.
Meryn moved up very close to him. "I am the Crystal Maven," she reminded him. "Uskarigin. There is none more powerful than Meryn in the Song of Uskar."
She backed away when Te'olig laughed at her.
"So, you wish me to claim you as my wife instead of Aulin?"
Te'olig said, denying nothing.
"What you desire is power,"
Meryn replied, and she looked up at him coyly.
"You are 15 years my senior,
and she is 15 your junior,
and still young and beautiful," Te'olig said viciously. "You should have begged me a decade ago, old hag."
Meryn's expression went stone cold.
"They will stop you," she promised. "You are Uskar Lauch, but having the tartan to claim as Uskar Tríath,
Elder Rebert grows frail.
Anna May will be named Uskar Forfak when Rebert is no more. There will be an Uskar Leach, and there will be an Uskar Forfak,"
Meryn said with confidence. Te'olig backed up a step and began to laugh.
"Unless I service Meryn as her husband," he said slyly.
"Uskar Tríath, Uskarigin," she said.
She was surprised that she had been so forward here. Her position was secure, after all. As the most powerful woman in the tribe, the unquestioned leader of the coven, she had been married twice, both long ago, but had been alone for decades now. She didn't need the companionship of a man, certainly. And though she thought Te'olig quite handsome, and found his strength and exploits extremely attractive, this wasn't about any of that.
No. She wanted to win. Wanted the most desired man in all of Uskar to desire her. She wanted to beat Aulin. That last thought had caught the Crystal Maven off balance. She had to work hard to keep the surprise off her face. Aulin was small and dark. For all the potential of the young woman, no, the girl, Meryn decided. She was not even of the coven.
and could only join that sisterhood with her blessing.
Lots of Uskar women had potential, but only one could be Uskar Regin. It made no sense to Meron that she should care about this, about Te Oleg and the girl he apparently found desirable, at all. But she did. "Aulan is the 13th old woman," Te Oleg said then, with angry finality. "If you do not do this, you will betray all that you hold dear of Uskar tradition, and you will betray me. That is not a wise choice, I assure you." The coldness in his voice sent a shiver through Meron's spine, but she held firm against the overt threat. Te Oleg snorted at her, turned, and left the tent. As soon as she was gone, Meron slumped and had to lean on a table to keep her feet. She was truly exhausted by her work with Kaya, and now emotionally drained from this unexpected and troubling encounter. How dare the Uskar Lauch demand of her his choice for the sacred coven? How dare he even speak of the 13th, while poor Kaya drew breath?
31. Headlong. The rope was still there. It was part of the tree now, with a branch actually growing around it. Almost, it seemed to Talmadge, as if the tree has come to accept the rope. He thought that fitting. Certainly his feelings about this place had changed, more dramatically than he had understood until he had stepped off his canoe and confronted the place once more. The ghost of Badger was long gone, exorcised from his thoughts. The weight vanished. Now he stood before the tree, and he thought of Chote, the love of his life, the woman who had shown him that his life was a journey, as narrow or as wide as he desired it to be. He missed her terribly in that moment, but still a smile of acceptance creased his face. The image of her severed leg flashed in his thoughts, but it was a fleeting thing, chased away by the many other sweet moments that had defined their years together. He wanted her back, desperately so, but he also appreciated that he had known her at all. Talmadge sighed and dropped his pack to the ground. He would camp here this night, and set off to the south in the late morning. Never again would he be on Loch Bjug when the morning fog hadn't fully cleared. He would never again remain on the lake for long, nor would he go more than a few feet from the shore. Kaer Seilich was a half-day's paddle, but it would likely take Talmadge 3 days to get there. He looked at the tree. He thought of Chote. He was in no hurry. He knew that Meron's reasoning was sound, the witch's insistence that he would not so easily ascend to a position of complete leadership haunted Te Oleg through the days. On more than one occasion, he even fancied the ways he might kill Anna May. The only thing stopping him from making the attempt was his knowledge that there were others besides that one man who could lay claim to the title of Uskar Forfach. That title was the sticking point, not the man. The tribe was typically led by 3 people, Uskar Forfach, Uskar Regin, and Uskar Lauch. Not 2. Uskar Triath was a rare title, saved for only the most exceptional men, men who were still young enough and strong enough to lead in times of battle, but also wise enough to serve as judge in all the mundane matters of the tribe. Even though Raybert had made the title of Uskar Forfach somewhat of a joke, but the man did not even accompany the tribe to the summer encampment, and was, by all accounts, quite unstable. When he passed, there would be many voices calling for a replacement. Te Oleg needed to do something dramatic to change that. His hand went reflexively to his waist, to the hidden sunstone and amethyst jewel. He considered his encounter with the fossa when he had sent the beast flying. He was fairly certain that he had stung it badly, without even trying. But he could not know. Could he really hope to kill the thing? Teolig took a deep breath and nodded, still not sure of that, but he was certain that in the previous encounter, the fossa had been wholly blind to him. Perhaps he and the three he had chosen wouldn't win against the fossa, but still, Teolig was convinced that he could hide from the fossa and get away. Thus, it was worth the chance.
For if he won, if he returned with the head of the dire fossa demon, none would dare speak against him in his ascent to Uskar Triath, not even Meryn.
The folk of Kaer Silach greeted Talmadge with warm hugs and fine meals, as if he hadn't missed a season. The last time they had seen him as a broken thing, reeling from the loss of Hote. This night, under the late summer stars, Talmadge finally told the tale of the attack on the lake. Gasps and mumbled prayers came back at him when he spoke of the monster. Even though all on Lochbjarg knew of the creature, very few had actually seen it.
Hote is the first eaten by Skaf since before you first arrived, Talmadge, Whisperer Braga, the leader of Kaer Silach, explained to him.
And you, Talmadge, are the only man I have ever known to escape an attack. The gods blessed your way.
The gods blessed your way, all the others said with reverence.
Talmadge stared at the leader, the whisperer of the village. Braga was not a physically imposing woman, though she was tall. Her hair and eyes shone brightly, giving her a wispy appearance, almost as if she might float away on a breeze. But any who had dealt with her knew that this only made Braga more impressive and formidable. She could put anyone, particularly a man, off balance with a sidelong glance, and she often did so to her advantage. Her remark truly touched Talmadge. To have the leader suggest that he had been blessed by the gods was about the highest form of acceptance any outsider could ever hope for here around Lochbjarg.
Perhaps if I knew your gods better, I wouldn't be so afraid to be on the water, Talmadge replied with a self-deprecating chuckle. It took me many days to cross Lochbjarg.
Blessed, Whisperer Braga corrected. Not bless. They pushed you to shore.
A meal escaped is often a meal delayed, and less often a meal avoided.
The chuckles around the fire clued Talmadge in to the woman's meaning. They said that he had been lucky. Not necessarily that the luck would hold. They also reminded him that he was dealing with a whisperer who weighed every word very carefully.
We are eager to take your wares, Braga went on. Your absence was hurtful, but we are short with pearls, and you are thick with gold and silver.
Talmadge nodded, for it was true enough. He had stockpiled quite the haul of trinkets, rings, fine chains and jewels over the last couple of years, mostly because without Lochbjarg, he had few connections who wanted such items in exchange for his fish and furs. Apparently, he had done better in accumulating barter than this tribe had done in gathering payment.
As always, Whisperer Braga, Kaer Silach is first to choose, he said respectfully.
How far will Talmadge go this year? The winds speak of early winter, and you have spoken of short paddles on the water.
I hope to visit as far as Fasach Cran, he replied,
and only when the name left his mouth did he realize just how badly he wanted to see that place again.
But I would keep my canoe here, if you agree, and walk.
That brought some surprised whispers around the fire.
You will not find many days there, if you even get there, Whisperer Braga warned. Your walk is longer by many days.
Talmadge nodded his understanding. The southern expanse of Lochbjarg was broken with swift rivers flowing down from the mountains, and long inlets and marshes, and in many areas along his way he would have to swing far inland to circumvent the obstacles. Still, those same inlets, like the one he had passed with Hote just beyond Karachan Shale, were the reason he had found his canoe so far from shore, and so vulnerable to scoff. He had no desire to try his luck with that again, no matter how inconvenient or inefficient a hike might be. "And your path will bring you to Frithfirch," Braga warned, referring to the foothills of the great mountain. Talmadge nodded, not surprised, but still determined to walk to Fossach Cran, and the villages in between that coveted place and this one.
"And the Reaper Moon will wear red this year," so whispered the creatures, said Braga.
Talmadge nodded, thinking he would do well to remember to have himself in the village for the 3 days of the fullest moon. He recalled his night with Cote, the last time he had seen such a moon, when they had witnessed some great commotion on the mountain. Yes, there were demons on Fearach's Buer, Uskar Daemon, at least, if not some greater, more sinister force. Still, Talmadge would walk, to Fossach Cran and back. Whatever might lurk up there could not be worse than the creature the tribes called Scarth. And so he walked out of Carr Sailach a couple of days later, confident of his choice.
"You're lucky you haven't lost it,"
Aulin said to Badlan, as she examined his hand and the blackened finger he had crushed under a stone the previous day. She immediately sighed and assumed a more sympathetic pose, realizing that part of her anger was coming from guilt, for not having come to visit the previous night. She went to work immediately with the Wedstone magic, imparting healing warmth to the ever-uncomplaining young man. She couldn't believe that she had found him working, and using that very broken hand. His tolerance for pain shocked her, and reminded her, painfully, that the lives of the Umas were ones of pure stoicism, else they would be murdered. Murdered by her tribe. Aulin felt some atonement in healing Badlan, though it was remedied to but a tiny bit of the pain the traditions of Uskar inflicted on these poor folk.
"You should be done for the night,"
Aulin said to him, and she sent another round of healing magic into his hand. "For 2 nights, you need to rest." She stopped when she saw Badlan looking at her and shaking his head emphatically. No, not looking at her, she realized, but looking past her. The young woman ducked as she turned about, and a good thing she had, for coming up the way, not far down the trail and stairs, was Elder Raybert. With a gasp, Aulin rolled aside and crawled under and behind a bush, settling in just as Raybert came around the last bend and over the last step.
"What are you doing, slave?"
the old man asked. Badlan held up his bruised, broken hand, and gave a little whimper, and raised the tone of his voice, Aulin noted, as if to mimic her own. He was trying to cover for her.
"Clever," Aulin thought.
And behind the bush, she shook her head as she considered the young man's earlier name, Thump, and the derisive implications.
"Do you think that excuses you from work?"
Raybert asked sharply, and he brought his arm up, small whip in hand. It was all Aulin could manage to stay concealed behind the bush, for truly she wanted to leap out when Raybert cracked the whip on poor Badlan's shoulder, a not uncommon occurrence she had learned in her many visits to the young man. Even though she should not have been surprised, though, actually seeing the brutality brought tears welling to Aulin's black eyes, and a level of fury she didn't know she possessed. She wanted to leap out of the brush, igniting the power of the grey bars, and launching Raybert away with a pair of sizzling lightning bolts. But she didn't. For Badlan's sake, more than her own, the frightened young woman stayed hidden, quiet.
"Move along," Raybert roared, and he whipped Badlan across the back as the young man hustled back to his work. "You finish that step this night, or I'll be taking all the skin from your back, idiot boy."
He cracked the whip again and again, in the air over Badlan's head. Aulin could barely see the old wretch from her angle, but enough to recognize the glee stamped upon his ugly face.
Again, she had to fight to contain herself. She thought she could easily dispatch the fool and drop him into a ravine. And who would be the wiser? But then she was crouching again, and even lower, sucking in her breath in terror, when a voice called out from far down the way.
"Rebert! Uskar Forfak, I would speak with you!"
Aulan knew that voice all too well.
"Finish the step," Rebert said one last time,
and he cracked the whip in the air just above Badlan's head and turned about to greet Te Orlik. Aulan flattened on the ground, desperate to make herself invisible. She tried to remind herself that she could get away, that she could ease back here and leap from a high cliff. But where would she go? There's no way she could be seen up here in the midst of the night and ever go back to the Uskar camp. Te Orlik began talking to Rebert, some questioning about how the old man could possibly stay alive up here year after year. But Aulan hardly noted the words, more concerned about whether their conversation would cover her retreat. Aulan thought her chance had come. She began to silently call upon the green stone set to her belly to lessen her weight, so she could silently recede. But then she heard Te Orlik become more specific with Rebert, and with words she could not dismiss.
"Why has the fossa not taken you?"
Te Orlik asked. Aulan's fear melted into curiosity.
"How can Rebert stay alone up here, year after year, and not be devoured by the demon that haunts Firoxbuer?"
How indeed? Aulan wondered, for she had seen the fossa up on a ledge not far from this place, and not far from Rebert's tent in the Uskar winter camp.
"Why would you speak of the fossa? Isabel will show her red face this season." "I care not," Rebert answered sternly. "The demon fossa comes through this place, but dares not stay. Uskar's song hurts its mind, you know. Hurts its mind, I say, and drives it mad."
Rebert gave a little wheezing laugh. Aulan winced and brought her hand to her belly when he admitted,
"Drives us all mad."
She remembered the crone, her first teacher, who had told her much the same thing. Aulan heard the words in her mind as clearly as the crone had told her. "One must not stay there too long, or one will be driven mad." Then she had used Rebert to argue that point. The crone had told her in no uncertain terms that this man, the elder of Uskar, was quite mad. Aulan felt the gemstone she had wedded to her body, heard their song in her heart. She would know them better, she quietly assured herself. They would not drive her mad.
"The demon fossa cannot resist the song of Uskar, yet cannot withstand the magic, not in body, but in mind," Rebert went on,
and Aulan swallowed hard, for it was almost as if he was reading and mocking her thoughts. She saw Rebert give a little shrug against the widening grin of Te Orlik. What was he about? Aulan wondered.
"Might that were not so different, we Uskar men and the demon fossa, eh?" Rebert said. "Might that were more bound to Isabel than Uskar, who makes whores of our women."
"Perhaps you are," Te Orlik replied, shocking Aulan. "Are you an old woman, then?"
Aulan couldn't tell if Rebert was taking the insult in stride, or if he was fighting back with a mocking taunt when he replied,
"Is that your play, Uskar Lauch?"
"When you're dead, I will be Uskar Triath," Te Orlik declared.
Rebert laughed again.
"You fancy your spatlings thick, young warrior," he said dismissively,
and he laughed as if the whole thing was a joke, and a preposterous one at that. With a wave of his hand, Elder Rebert started down the way, back to the winter encampment.
"Oh, it will be,"
Aulan heard Te Orlik promise.
too quietly for the departing man to hear. After Isabel's blood moon.
Aulan's eyes went wide, for she knew at once what Te Olig meant, and what he had planned. It was so clear to her. Te Olig meant to kill the Fossa, and use that unprecedented glory to claim the tribe as his own. The young woman replayed Raybert's words, and thought back to the fight between Breyth and the demon creature, of how her lightning, bolts that would have melted a man, she was sure, for she had felt the power flowing through her spirit and through Breyth's spear, had done nothing to the Fossa, except to madden it even more. How might Te Olig?
Enjoy your time, idiot, the brute shouted at Badlan, breaking Aulan's train of thought. Perhaps Uska Triath Te Olig will suffer you to live. Te Olig's laugh had no mirth in it at all. It sounded purely wicked to Aulan, and was confirmed for her as Te Olig finished. Likely not.
32. The Crystal Maven's Play.
It is secure, Agmor assured Te Olig, referring to a shallow cavern down the rocky slope on the back side of the Uma's Grove. You will stay with the prisoner until Isabel shows her face, Te Olig instructed Agmor. And one of you with him always, he added, to Ralid and Agart. The other to me, and back with word. The three younger men nodded. We go for one thing now, Te Olig reminded. And only one. A single prisoner, nothing more.
There will be no raid on the lake this season?
Ralid asked. Te Olig shrugged, because it didn't matter. The Blood Moon was expected in 2 weeks. If a major raid was to happen, it would have to be after that. Few expected it, though, for the winds were already turning, and there was talk of breaking the summer camp immediately following the Blood Moon for an early journey to the Winter Plateau. The war leader held out his hands, beckoning. Give me your weapons, that I might have them blessed, he said.
This was to be secret, you said,
Agmor replied, handing over his spear. Te Olig nodded and smiled. Our secret. We four. And one other. Now go and prepare. We leave at dawn. He gathered the four spears, a pair of hand axes, and a pair of long daggers, and hustled quietly around the back of the encampment, coming to the tent of Aulan. With a glance to make sure he was not seen, he slipped into the tent through the young woman's cleverly hidden back flap, and waited.
You cannot,
Conobra said, her face a mask of shock. Mirren fixed her with an icy stare, reminding her that it was not wise to challenge the word of the Uskarigin.
Elara's daughter is, Conobra started. The choice is mine, given to me by Uskar's whispers. Gavina?
Another of the witches remarked, seeming as perplexed as Conobra.
A snaggle-toothed dullard, Conobra said.
Mirren slapped her across the face.
Conobra fell back, anger flashing in her grey eyes,
but only for a moment, as she stared at the unrelenting Mirren. Her face flushed with shame, for such words were not appropriate, certainly not now. The 13 of the coven, no matter who they were, demanded respect without question.
I am surprised, Uskarigin,
Conobra said, lowering her gaze to the floor and shaking her head.
Aulan's power in the Crystal Caves seemed it is about more than simple power,
Mirren told her, told them all.
And I was surprised, too,
she said, softening her tone and putting a hand on Conobra's shoulder.
But I'll not question Uskar's will. Gavina has affinity, and she understands our pleas. I am not sure that any of us could say the same of the brat Aulan. There will be another time,
another of the witches remarked.
Meryn snapped her head around to freeze the witch with a glower.
"Not for that one," she said,
with more emotion than she should have, she realized, for she did not want any of her witches to come to realize that this was personal, not the whisper of their god.
"I don't understand," Olin said. She had returned to her tent after supper, hoping to be out on the mountain quickly, but only to find Te Orlig waiting for her.
"You do not need to understand. You only need to do what I have told you to do."
Olin looked at the handful of weapons the Uskar Lauch had placed before her. He had told her to bless them, to excite the magic within them, to make them more powerful. But there was no raid or approaching battle. No signs of the she about that Olin had heard. And if it was for a hunt, the men would have used different weapons than these. Crystal spear tips thick with different magic, like turquoise and malachite. These were weapons of war.
"I cannot... I mean, I'm not supposed..."
she stammered, and she wasn't even sure of where to begin.
"You can, and you will, because I told you to,"
came the simple answer. Olin swallowed hard, terribly afraid. Memories of her encounter with Breyth filled her head, of how the man had taken her, and her virginity, right there in front of Shona. He hadn't said a word, just had done his business and left. Was Te Orlig going to do the same now?
She certainly didn't want any sexual intimacy with this man who claimed that he would be her husband. But if he demanded it, and she refused, the result would be violent.
Olin did a quick survey of the gemstones, and reminded herself that she had become an instrument of Uskar, a living weapon.
"Be quick," Te Orlig demanded.
"We have no fire."
"You don't need a fire. That is for the entertainment of the onlookers and the pride of the witches."
Olin looked at him curiously at that. Was it true? Probably, she thought. But how would he know that? No matter. Olin took up the weapons, one by one, and sent her thoughts into their respective crystals. She found the song, and pulled it forth, amplifying it with her own energy, until it reverberated within the crystal, a vibration that would last for days. She felt other curious sensations, mostly from the sapphire strand about her ankle, hinting to alterations in the various songs she had heard. But she dismissed them, not willing to take any chances at all here. She would do exactly as Te Orlig had demanded, as quickly as possible, and hope that he'd then go on his way and bother her no more. Her hand trembled as she at last handed the 8th weapon back, for she feared that Te Orlig would spin her about and bend her over. But he simply nodded, gathered up the haul and said,
"You will tell no one."
Then he slipped out the back flap of the tent. Olin exhaled. What was that about? Why had he come to her in private? To awaken the power of weapons used only for raids, when there was no raid? She rested back, and sat there for a long while in the dark, wondering, her thoughts turning to that newer sensation, the one from the sapphire chain. Of all the gemstones she had set upon her body, she wasn't sure about those small flecks of sapphire. They were strong with magic, but from everything she could tell, their effects would alter shape, power, or form to other magic. Thus far, they hadn't revealed any of their own powers. Perhaps she would learn better when she was entered into the coven, she decided. And she began to collect her wits, and thought to collect some food, so that she could go and visit Badlan and the caves. That had been her intention, at least. But the visit from Te Orlig had unnerved her. She couldn't risk a journey this night. Perhaps he had actually noted her hiding in the brush on the way, when he had come to speak with Raybert. Perhaps Te Orlig meant to surprise Olin and Badlan with the very weapons she had just enchanted, that he and his companions could kill them both. It was all too much for the young woman, so she sat there, in the dark, and pondered.
As he approached the rendezvous, Teoleg spotted Ralid and Argmor alone. And when he paused to consider that, the war leader hung back, hidden in the shadows. Soon after, he noted the approach of the third man, coming down fast from the Uskar camp. He let Agart beat him to the others, then came in cautiously, eavesdropping.
"It's true," he heard Agart say.
"Why?"
Ralid replied.
"Because Braith died," a clearly shaken Argmor asked. "The war leader will not be pleased."
Teoleg crashed into their midst.
"About what?" he demanded.
The three looked to each other nervously, but Argmor spoke up before Teoleg could demand an answer once more.
"Meirin has chosen Gavina for the coven."
It was all Teoleg could do to hold on to the bundle of weapons.
"How do you know this?" he demanded,
but he couldn't keep the rage out of his voice.
"We heard two women talking about it, just over the rise,"
Argmor explained.
"The whispers are throughout the camp. Meirin was in Gavina's tent telling her,"
added Agart.
"Mulgaire told me," he added,
referring to an older man, Gavina's husband.
"He lamented that it could not have happened sooner, when he was still able to hunt and fight."
Teoleg huffed, but didn't respond. He sorted his own weapons, and threw the other six to the ground at the feet of his three warriors.
"They are blessed," he told them. "You go, and do not fail me. A single prisoner, nothing more. I will find you at the cave on the dawn of the sixth day. If you don't have my captive, then better for you to die in the foothills."
He turned about and stormed away, gnashing his teeth with frustration. How could this have happened? How dare Meirin? There was much he needed to learn, but what Teoleg did know was that this would not stand. Aulin finally found her resolve and the confidence that Teoleg would not be back to her that night. She gathered up a heavy cloak and moved for the back flap. She stopped when the front flap opened instead, letting the light of a lantern flood into the room.
"Uskar again?"
she asked, recognizing Meirin and Conobra entering her tent. It occurred to her then that Teoleg's demands of her might have been at Meirin's request. Was blessing those weapons some sort of a test? The last test before she was asked to join the coven?
"Sit,"
Meirin told her, waving absently at a pile of furs just inside the door. The woman's tone gave Aulin pause, for it was not the voice she would expect from one who was about to offer her the greatest opportunity to which an Uskar woman could aspire. She shuffled over and plopped down on the rugs obediently, but neither Meirin nor Conobra joined her there. Conobra, in fact, went instead for the cabinet where Aulin's magical crystals were kept, and without asking, the woman gathered them up.
"You'll not need these now," Meirin explained.
Aulin didn't ask outright, but wondered if perhaps she would be given new crystals, more powerful and diverse.
"Yes, Uskar Regin," she replied. "Gavina will join the coven as the 13th witch,"
Meirin stated bluntly.
"It will not be you, girl. You are not ready, and may never be. You must learn now the more mundane tasks of an Uskar woman, and do them well, so that some man might still claim you as his wife."
Aulin wanted to reply, but her lips would not move.
"Gavina?" Gavina was nearly 20 years her senior, and could barely evoke magic from the crystals.
Aulin liked her well enough, for she was possessed of some sweetness, but she hardly heard the song of Uskar, even when it sounded like a leopard's roar in Aulin's heart.
How could they pick her?
What would Gavina bring the coven beyond Aulin? Aulin had more power pierced to her body now than most, if not all, collections of crystals in the tribe. And she had found a truer method to use the song of Uskar. How she wanted to show that to Meirin at that awful moment. And it was an awful moment. More so than Aulin would have ever believed. She had not realized how badly she wanted her place in the coven until now, when it was likely forever denied. She wanted to argue.